Welcome to the Tour Life Podcast from Well Better Best. I'm Janine, your host, integrative nutrition health coach and personal trainer. In the past 10 years, I've had the privilege of meeting some of the most interesting and hardworking professionals in the music industry. Whether you are a fan of live music or someone who actually puts on the shows, you'll find some great stories, advice, and encouragement to live a happier, healthier life doing what you love. Today's guest is a tour director who has worked with artists such as Linkin Park, Enrique Iglesias, and Backstreet Boys, among many others. He is the co-founder and president of the global nonprofit Event Safety Alliance. He is also one of the founders of Showmakers, a platform which was developed to share industry content, facilitate conversations, provide thought leadership, and showcase organizations that are dedicated to the live events community. In this episode, we discuss how self-reflection can help you understand who you are and what role you can play in this world, the importance of prioritizing the human behind the work above all else, the value of becoming an empathetic listener, how Chester Bennington's death by suicide opened his eyes to the underlying mental health difficulties that were closer than they appeared, how mental health first aid training shifted his perspective on leadership, and how to invest in yourself in order to be equipped to take care of the humans you work with. You can find him on Instagram at Digby Jim. Here is my conversation with Jim Digby. Hi, Jim. Thank you so much for joining me on the Tour Life podcast. You are one of the people who I have just been so excited to hear more from and to learn a little bit of your story.
Hi, Janine. Thanks so much for giving me the honor to be here with you. You're doing great work. And, you know, as we dive into the deeper depths of COVID and things like that, it's great that there are people like you out there making the story relevant about, you know, self-care and that we're all just human. And I appreciate you.
Thank you, Jim. And let's get started a little bit talking about how you even entered the music industry. I know early on in your career, you were working at a couple nightclubs and things like that. So did you always know that you wanted to work in the industry, or did it just sort of happen like it happens for some people?
It's funny. It's a great question. And I remember it clearly. And it goes way, way, way back. So buckle up. I was in fifth grade, 10 years old. And my teacher, that fifth grade teacher, Mrs. DeJohn, was the first one that I really connected with. And she made me the master of ceremonies for the May Day parade and the technician. And that was it. I was hooked. And she passed my name on to the junior high school arts, television and theater arts teacher, Connie Dyer, who on the first day of sixth grade took me under her wing. She said, I heard about you, and took me under her wing. And I immersed myself in the theater arts and from a junior high school onward. I was blessed to be in a school district in those days where the arts were well supported. We had a television studio, we had a theater. I was a mediocre student and I could walk to the school. So I really just dove in and was got through academia in the theater and arts programs.
I love that. It was definitely, you knew from early on.
I knew, yeah. And it's funny because in this time of self-reflection and self-examination, I think I now realize that one of the driving factors was life wasn't comfortable at home. There were challenges between my mom and dad that made that space not the best space to be in all the time. And I think now I see that what I was doing possibly early on was finding my own family, finding a place where the environment was fun and the environment was fulfilling as a human. And because I was with people who also enjoyed working in the theater arts program, it was kind of like I had a second family even back then. So I'm not sure about those things, but if I think deeply about who I was and what the world was then, and where that's evolved to now, where you get to choose your own family every time you go on tour, it may have had something to do with that.
And, you know, you mentioned some self-reflection. So tell me about what you've found thinking back from your transition, you know, to high school, where it was very much just, you know, a part of your day-to-day. We go to school, we have these options given to us, but then when you go out into the world and then you have to make a choice about what direction you're going to take, where did you go and how did you land into actually starting your career?
Yeah. So I was, you know, as most young people are, I was all over the place. I had this really happy place in the theater and the television studios and being the AV nerd. I also tried on, you know, football for a minute and baseball for a minute. I was a volunteer firefighter for 6 years when I was super young. My dad really wanted me to go to college, so I tried that on after high school and spent a year in college, and college and I didn't fit. And then went to electronics trade school where it was a good fit. I was a tinkerer by nature. I'd like to build things. I like to blow things up as young boys do. And then that trade school really kind of discovered this almost natural understanding of how electrons flowed and, you know, how mechanical things operated. And coming out of trade school, my mom had found an ad in a newspaper about a nightclub that was opening up outside of Philadelphia. It was being constructed and opening. It was a dinner theater and a nightclub. And it was coincidentally while that club was under construction. So I applied and was able to land my first professional job right out of trade school in this environment where the theater was operational and the nightclub was being constructed. There was an interim job there where I was fixing ATM machines. But there was, when I went for, because it was a, when for ATM machines were first becoming a thing and they were first appearing in the world, I was carrying a gun and going in and repairing ATM machines. But then this theater nightclub opened and it was, you know, it was right back into all the joy of being in the arts and entertainment space.
So your dad was pushing you into college.
Yeah.
And what were you like, were you just doing like general education courses?
Yeah, I was doing business administration, and I was also ROTC, Reserved Officer Training Corps, because I thought I wanted to be in the military. And at the end of year one, the ROTC program, I believe, if I remember it correctly, they needed you to commit to 4 years of service. And at that time, at 18, you know, 4 years felt like a lifetime. So there was no way I was going to do that. And I was just not, I wasn't as inspired in academia as I was in actually doing things, and specifically things around the theater, arts, television world.
How did your parents react to that? I see your mom clearly kept an eye out for something that would interest you, but what about your dad?
I think he got over it. You know, there wasn't a battle around it. It was, you know, more of a disappointment for him that I wasn't going to university. He was, you know, he was very much an academic out of Notre Dame and deep into studies, postgraduate work. It wasn't a deep wound for him. It just wasn't what he wanted. And then, of course, the entertainment business wasn't familiar to him. So it wasn't, you know, he didn't see a path to success. And when he passed, it was just as I was establishing myself in the touring space, and you know, he was beginning to recognize that it was a real career, it was a real pathway, and that I would be okay. Sadly, he didn't get to see where we are today.
Does that give you a little bit more of a connection, I guess, to what you're doing? Does it make you feel a little bit more like it has to be significant in the way that you do your work? Because the reason I'm asking this is because, you know, when I think of the way that, you know, your dad had a certain expectation for you, but then, you know, your mom still looked out for you in a way to figure things out. And then you weren't it wasn't like a direct path into the entertainment industry, but then you were like, okay, this feels good. And then, yeah, like how did that feel to find that feeling and then actually be able to make it a real career?
It's a good question. I think when you're young, in your 20s, you may not recognize that the bringing together passion and a career is a real blessing. And I think, you know, we may take that for granted when we're young that, oh my gosh, I'm doing something I love, but it's my job. And I think later in life, you come to realize, or at least for me, I came to realize, wow, how blessed I am to be doing this thing that I love so much and that I'm so passionate about, and it's paying the bills. The juxtaposition of those things is a blessing. It really is. And to say I felt it when I was in fifth grade is unique. Not everybody does. I don't say that intended to come off as, well, why haven't you discovered your thing? It's just, I've had a journey that felt like I knew where that was coming from a very young age. So there, you know, this, it's in my DNA to be here. It's, you know, for whatever set of complicating circumstances, like was I building a family that was more tactile than the one at home? Was I creating circumstances that allowed me to escape some of the uncomfortable things that might have been happening at home? I don't know those things. I've placed that baggage onto it. I've conflated those two stories. And I think that there's some likelihood that they are the real reason why it's so important for me, this business, and why the humans in this business are so important for me, is that I have this real love for what we do and who we are when we do it. We're a really unique breed.
So when did you realize that the people you were working with meant more to you than just passerby coworkers?
I think it's been an evolution, Janine. I think, you know, the human part of it is the best part of it for me. You know, the people we get to do the work with every day, the people we get to hear cheer our work, the work of the, you know, when the curtain goes down and the lights go out, that really is the thing for me that's the icing on the cake. It's been an evolution. You know, we've all evolved, and to say that I got it right when I was in my 20s would not be true. When I was in my 30s would not be true. 40s would not. You know, I'm still evolving. I'm still professionally developing, and values are changing, not just for me, but for society as a whole. You know, I've had a unique perspective on the rock and roll world because I didn't come from a place where I wanted to be a drummer and I wanted to have a band. I came from a place where I was a tech. I knew that backstage was my domicile, and I don't think beyond, you know, talking head type stuff, I don't think I've ever wanted to be on stage as a performer. So it's made my journey unique in the sense that there's never been this conflict of, man, when am I going to get my big break to play a guitar on stage? I'm perfectly fine backstage. That's where I belong. And my journey didn't start in music and rock and roll. My journey started in this theater and then in this nightclub. And then from there, it was Disney. And from Disney, it was film school. And from film school, it was a corporate tour. And then from corporate tour to rock and roll. So the things that influenced me from a very young age are my set of circumstances that have created the who that I am, and they're unique to me. And they're, you know, every one of us has our own story around that. What's made us who we are? I just think that I've recognized what my circumstances are, and I'm trying to play to those strengths and acknowledge those weaknesses and be better.
Was that something that you did on purpose, trying to figure out who you were, and what triggered you to want to figure that out?
That's a great question. I think life is complicated and it's messy, and I had a messy relationship with my mother. I did not have a messy relationship with my dad, and That messiness caused me to be everything that I thought was in opposition to my mom. And for instance, you know, she was going through menopause when I was very young in my teens, and it was an awful menopause. It was the kind of menopause that drove her to attack my dad unnecessarily. And there were these moments, right? And that made me try to be a conflict resolution person. When it would start, I would try to jump in and try to make it stop. And I think that those were the early markers that created me, you know, caused me to try to be a more peaceful person. Now, mind you, you know, I'm saying that now in 2021, but there have been parts of my journey where those very same microaggressions that I witnessed in my mom have come out in me in the way that I led. And that's, you know, I recognize now how awful that was. I can't change those things in the past. I can kind of try to identify where they've come from and come to peace with them and learn not to do them again. So I think your question was, what caused me to self-evaluate? I think I've always kind of been that person. It's what I've done with that's evolved over time. And my father, for instance, was a Catholic priest for 12 years before he left the priesthood and married my mother. He was a very docile man. You know, he read books of random digits, you know, as out of interest, trying to find order in chaos. So when you found my dad anywhere in the world, you found him sitting very peacefully, being very reflective, and trying to create order to chaos. That was the guy I knew. So he never got above here ever, you know, and his discipline methodology was, you know, oh, son, you've really let me down. And that hurt. I mean, that really ripped at your soul, right? Rather than screaming and shouting. But then I had my mom, who was the exact opposite of all of that. And somewhere in the middle is where my ideologies have come from. And I find myself very much in my own personal dichotomy. Sometimes I'm my dad and sometimes I'm my mom. And I'm trying to learn to respect the challenges my mom had as a woman growing up through the 40s and 50s and 60s, and how they manifested in her, and be at peace with what I perceive to be really difficult days and how I might have made them worse, and channel those observations into a commitment to myself to try to never be like that again. It's life's journey, right? I mean, that's what we try to do. We continually, hopefully we're all continually just trying to get better and figure it out.
It's interesting how getting in the mind space where you want to have empathy for other people and you want to understand where they're coming from really puts you in a place where you start to realize that the empathy is really more self-awareness of the way that you are interpreting other people's lives and the things that they do.
I think it's yes. I think it's also at some point in my journey, listening became, you know, I kept hearing this message of be an empathetic listener, be a listener, be a real listener, be present. And I read a book on the recommendation of one of the managers I've worked with, Nonviolent Compassionate Communication I have it here, Marshall Rosenberg. And in reading that, I was able to, you know, be reflective as I was reading and realize that my tactic all along had been wrong. I'd been off the mark. I didn't, you know, we don't, in our business, we don't have to take any training whatsoever to get these roles. And to be leaders and to carry a duty of care and to carry management, there's no training. So, you know, it's either you're open to self-discovery and self-growth and self-evaluation because you want to survive or because you want to be a better human or some combination of both. And it was in reading this book and some other milestones along the way where I started to understand, oh, I'm not listening. I'm speaking, I'm trying to drive where my perspective is into everything that I'm doing, and that's not leadership. And so that book and these other moments have caused me to stay immersed in, you know, be constantly listening to what those around me need, but be constantly listening to what the universe is trying to tell me. Like, get out of your own head, get out of your own ego, and be compassionate. And it's a constant journey to be that.
Yeah. And I think in our careers, you know, like you mentioned, a lot of it, it's just on the job training. And a lot of people, I mean, I would say all people aren't natural born leaders. I mean, it's a practice, and it's something that you do because you have to. And a lot of times we think that being a good leader is really knowing how to fix everything, knowing all of the answers, being able to take the heat for everything, when really, when you start to look inward, it really flips all of your ideals of what a good leader is on its head.
Absolutely true. You know, that adage of being a born leader, I don't know how you identify that. I don't know how, you know, I guess it's similar to being a born musician, right? Leadership is an art form. The only thing I can remember in my young childhood at 6 years old was telling my mom one day after having to take the trash out, I'm going to have 6 children, and one's going to be a carpenter, and one's going to be a plumber, and one's going to be, because I was overwhelmed with the chores that I was getting, right? And my solution was, I'm going to lead a large family to do these chores for me. So I don't know if that's, you know, if that's an admission of not wanting to do the work, or if that's just, you know, how this kid, this particular individual, twisted the idea of leading. I don't know. But, you know, as to your point about discovering that leadership isn't really you go do this, it's really what tools do you need to get the job done and be your best self. That's the moment, right? That's when you're really leading. And it was only recently I challenged myself for no other reason than my own to take the project management professional training. And in that training, which is only last year, I discovered that management and leadership are two different things. And I was trying to, and then, well, of course, there's, oh my gosh, rip myself apart. What have you done? And looking back, I realized that I was trying to lead and manage, and that I only do one of those things well, and it isn't the management part. So by trying to do both of those things, I was minimizing the value of either one, because I could lead, but then I'd be stuck with management, and then that would take away my leadership because I'd be frustrated with the fact that I couldn't manage. So I've had this kind of recent aha moment where, I think I'm more of a leader than I am a manager. I like the process of connecting with the human and empowering the human and making the human helping to have the other humans to have the tools they need to do the job, and the confidence that I've got their back. And come on, what do we need to do to get this done? Let's go do it together. And that management, the idea of keeping track of those things and the tick box component of managing a particular thing is not my strongest suit. Now, I'm now challenging myself with, don't use that as an excuse to not do that. You need to be able to do both. I'm still in that process.
I love that. I love that you also said that was only a year ago that you challenged yourself to take that extra step to really discover what it is about yourself that you're not the best at, that you can improve on. I think that's something that a lot of us have trouble with, because especially when you're put in a leadership position, you know, it's like you almost have to have this, you feel like you have to have this outrageous confidence in yourself, which really blocks you from actually ever becoming good at what you do.
Yeah. And I think, Janine, maybe it's that. Maybe it's this outrageous confidence. While I may appear cocky to those outside who don't know me, the truth is I'll run behind a closed door somewhere and then begin this complete self-evaluation. You know, why did it land like this? What did I do wrong? Why is that person not seeing how much belief I have in them? And why does it feel like there's a conflict here when I'm just trying to demonstrate how much I support that person? So, and I've said, it's funny because that leads me to remember, for a very long time, I installed this process of not wanting to fire anyone because they had one misstep. I felt like my process that was self-defined was, hey, that was a mistake. Let's not make that again. You know, and I would evolve. I'd have this escalation in myself where it would go from this kind of friendly reminder to kind of brotherly nudge to, hey, come on, you know, and then that would continue to escalate to the point where I felt I had given X number of options for correction. And then, and only then, when there was still no course correction, would it be a case where we're just not working out together here. You know, we've got to move on and do something different, because I think we've tried everything in our arsenal to get you to the place you need to be, or to help you understand why the behavior is not suitable. And it doesn't feel like you really want to get to a suitable behavior. So let's make a change. That is to say that I've always wanted to make sure that I'm not just taking the easy road. I'm not taking the easy road and saying, nope, this isn't working, you're done. And rather try to get that person to come up through all means necessary, even in some wildly aggressive ways, which I'm not proud of, to get somebody, you know, rattle them out of their head to get there and still lose. I've felt, rightly or wrongly, that if I commit to that process, by the time I get to that component, I've tried everything I can. And that's just, you know, just something I did with me. Who knows if it was the right tact or not? Only time will tell.
That's true, right? Only time. I want to know how you got to the point where you realize that, because what I'm getting from you is that you see opportunity for growth in people. And you see that people aren't just defined by what they are at any given moment in time. They can be as much as they want to be, as long as they're willing to have an open mind and they're willing to grow and learn and ask questions. Let's link that to mental health, which is, I think, why we're all really here. What is something that took you from a place of thinking of mental health in the abstract into really realizing that there are things that you can do as a person, as a leader, to help raise awareness about the importance of it and how it actually affects every single thing that you do?
I think it's always been recognized, but maybe not valued, and in the way that it was after the death of Chester Bennington, death by suicide of Chester Bennington. I think that escalated the learning process and the deep connection to, wow, that really hurt, right? That was so close. You know, he's somebody I had known up for 16, 17 years up to that point, and had been a part of his existence. We'd been a part of each other's existence in a professional sense for a long time. And the shock and awe of his death by suicide was certainly step one in holy crap. Because by the time we got to that moment in time, I had assumed everything that I knew about mental health. I had assumed the things, you know, I had assumed because I was moderately well-read that I understood these things. Not that I read books on mental health, but just that I was a well-informed person. That's what I thought of myself. And then on this journey, on the run-up to his death, you know, he presented himself as someone who had mastered the beasts that fought him. You know, he spoke openly about those beasts. He spoke about them in a way in this year that demonstrated to us a greater amount of control and recognition over them. That's what it felt like to us. And when that moment came, it was extra difficult to comprehend. Because we felt that what we saw right up to that moment was somebody who had a better control over it. And as it turns out, you know, the next series of things that happened were, thankfully, the organization is so beautiful and they care about their humans, you know, we were able to do some group counseling together and we were all able to be together and work through it to whatever extent possible. But in those moments of group counseling, in a team of people that I believed I had been setting up an environment on tour that allowed folks to be truly close, that allowed us to be aware of each other's challenges, or, you know, if someone were having extra problems with related to something outside of work, I thought that I had set up an environment where someone on the team would be able to be communicated in the communication chain for that. But here, lo and behold, during these meetings, people were expressing the other mental health challenges they were having. And I sat like, what? How did I not know that? How did I not know that that person's going through that thing or that person's going through that thing? How is it possible I didn't know that? And it was in that moment I realized that everything I thought I was doing, I obviously had not hit the mark. Meaning, I thought I had set up a mental health kind of comfortable environment, even through my own, not lack of knowledge and my own microaggression behavior. And it turns out I hadn't. And it also, that comes along with the challenge between being a leader and being a friend. You know, as a leader, even though you don't think of yourself as that, and you think of yourself as accessible to everyone on the team still only sees leader or manager. And the world we live in is not set up to have those kinds of conversations that are close to the heart between team and manager. It's just not what society has set up previously. So in these discoveries in the wake of his passing and in this counseling period, to hear that team members were having these issues or that were battling these other issues and we didn't know about it, it was clear to me that I had not achieved what I thought I had achieved in creating that environment. So one of the first things I did was take this mental health first aid training, which doesn't make me a mental health professional, but it did teach me that everything I thought I knew about watching out for someone who's having mental health issues or whose brain hurts or is potentially ideating around suicide, I was wrong. All the assumptions I had made were wrong. And I think you take a pre-assessment before you take the class, and I believe there was something on the order of 20 questions on the pre-assessment. I got two of them right because everything I thought I knew about mental health was wrong. And it was in that moment that I was like, ah, what have you done? And then in taking that training, it was so visceral, especially in the wake of Chester's death. It was so visceral for me that everything that was being conveyed was being conveyed and touching some moment of the 16-year journey of being by his side professionally. And I don't believe there was a moment where I felt, well, geez, I could have changed the outcome. I know that I couldn't have. But there were moments in this training, in this learning, where I thought, ah, I was so not the right person, you know? And somebody tells you, you know, this is an example of what came out of that learning was, you know, somebody tells you they had voices in their head. To me, someone who's not challenged with that, voices in my head means, you know, what I hear when I talk to myself in a quiet room or on an airplane or wherever. That to me is the interpretation of voices in my head. That's what it means. We did an experiment in the class where one person was the person who had voices in their head. Another person was their outer soul with a rolled up newspaper talking into the ear of the person who had voices in their head. And the third person was the one who was in, and this is difficult to explain, but the one who was in communication with the sufferer. And to have someone talking in a tube in my ear as I was emulating the person who was suffering from voices in my head was, oh my gosh, who am I to presume I know what voices in my head means? You know, we're all manufactured differently when we come into the world. And voices in the head for me is not what voices in the head for you is. it's potentially something miles apart. It's potentially this very loud voice that's saying, F you, don't talk to me while I'm talking to you. And it's disrupting my ability to focus on you and understand what you're saying. And all I'm hearing is this loud, overwhelming voices in my head. And to come to that realization that voices in my head for someone else means something completely different just tore the rug out from underneath me. It started this discovery that I didn't know a thing. And when it comes to this, and that, you know, suddenly empathy had an entirely different definition, and that I am not in any place as a human being to presume that I know what another human being is hearing when I speak, or hearing when someone else speaks to them, or is meaning what they're saying. It really kind of like right over the head. You have to stop thinking you know what someone else is going through. I'm ashamed that it took that to get to it, and that it didn't come until I was 55 or 54 years old. I'm glad that it came though, because now I can take that passion for our humans and desire to create change and desire to demonstrate compassion and empathy and the desire to see our industry continue to thrive and the humans in it continue to thrive. And I can take that moment in time and hopefully do something that affects change for all of us going forward. I'm so sad that he's gone, but I'm not sad of the lessons that we've learned.
That really seems to kind of turn your whole reality on its head.
Yeah.
So what are some of the priorities that you've listed for yourself when it comes to helping other people understand that concept?
Well, I think, you know, for those who are bored enough to listen to this conversation from me, you know, hopefully there's some awareness generated by conveying that story. I think that the, you know, even when I took it in 2018, 2019, it was clear that all of society should be taking the mental health first aid training, right? It's no different from knowing how to bandage a wound or, you know, what to do with somebody when they have a heart attack. It, to me, and I'm only discovering all of this now, but to me, it is the most important training we can put in our, we can offer to our humans, our felt, you know, regardless of what business we're in. You know, I took the youth mental health first aid training as a father of young children. And, you know, I live in fear of what the world will bring to them. And I want to know how to know when there's a need to inject myself and intercede in the potential problem. Is that mental health, or is that they're depressed? Or, you know, as a father, I want to be able to jump in there. And it was also clear to me in that classroom that why don't all of our teachers have this training? Why don't all our nurses have this training? Why doesn't everybody on the road have this training? Because we work in such a emotional roller coaster of a job. You know, it really does make more sense to have mental health first aid training almost than it does to have CPR training. So.
It really does. And actually, this reminded me of the Behind the Scenes Foundation, which you are on the board on, correct?
Yeah, I was just going to talk about that. It's, you know, Lori Rubenstein and the folks at the Behind the Scenes Foundation do really care about our humans. And there are a great number of people who are inspired to create change in this space. And just recently, just in the last week, I think, Lori and Brian Honeycutt and the rest of the team around the Behind the Scenes Foundation were able to make this available through long work and long hours virtually, in a combination of virtual and real life humans online, to everyone. It was really difficult to find it when I wanted to take it. There were very few classes offered, and you would have to, you know, you would really have to hunt to find it. But now, thanks to Behind the Scenes Foundation, Behind the Scenes Charity, it's available online. And I believe all of the early classes have already sold out. So Lori and the team are looking for ways to put more class, make more classes available for everyone. To me, it's like, oh, thank goodness, you know, anybody who wants to be responsible in this place, anybody who wants to lead with this kind of compassion and really understand the dynamics of a person who may not perceive the world the way you do or I do, this is absolutely essential. And it's not just about suicide prevention. It's about, you know, I'm having a bad day. My brain needs a Band-Aid today. And how can I, as a leader, spot those things? Or what are those questions that I should be asking to say, hey, does your brain need a Band-Aid today? I'm here for you. No problem. You want to take a mental health break? Let's go do that. Or not say anything at all. Just sit. And the tools that I came away with are super, super important, I think, especially in our business. And I'm so excited that everybody can take it now from behind the scenes.
Yeah, it's so exciting. And actually, it really blew my mind when I started looking at the menu of services that Behind the Scenes provides. And something that really stuck out to me was the toolbox talks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that is a practical way to infuse wellness into a tour.
Yeah. And into the people you work with that day. So the toolbox talks, actually, you know, the Event Safety Alliance 8-9 years ago, toolbox talks were one of the mechanisms that we valued early on. There's a book called The Checklist Manifesto by Atul Gawande that talks about the value of these toolbox talks. You know, he went around the world and he looked in 5 or 6 different sectors and studying the idea of what it takes to get a team to come together, get everyone informed, and then go tackle the thing, whether that's stock market, operating room, whatever. His studies showed that in the operating room, if the doctor, before anybody cut, the doctor said, right, hi, I'm Dr. Smith. We're going to be doing surgery on the left arm today. We're going to be removing that, putting a steel one in, and I'll be making these calls. And then the nurse would say, I'm Nurse Ratchet. I'm going to do these things. And the anesthetist would say, I'm, you know, whoever the anesthetist, and I'm going to be administering these doses at this time, and we'll start the watch in 15 minutes. So just by taking that, I think it's 7 points, and it has to happen in under a minute or 3 minutes. Forgive me, I'm trying to quote something I haven't read in a while. And just by doing that, change the outcome by significant percentage of bad operations in the operating room. So we talk about the toolbox talks with respect to safety in the morning, and the stage manager takes the loading dock and gathers the local crew around. Here's our show today, but we've got 15 trucks. You know, these are the high risk moments. We'll be sure to let you know. There'll be a red light flip, you know, yellow light turning around on the stage when we're doing rigging overhead. Watch out for the forklifts. Make sure you've got clothes, shoes on. You know, just taking that 2 or 3 minutes to bring everyone together creates a team. And it is the difference maker of success and the tenor with which you work through a day when it comes to safety. Now bring in mental health first aid and bring in the idea of adding mental health to that toolbox talk says, I care about you. So in that toolbox talk example, hey, I just want you guys to know, we recognize, you know, and this is the time we're coming away from, by the way. I'll use the example of coming out of COVID. We're all rusty. We're all super rusty, which puts us at an elevated risk because maybe the forklift driver has forgotten to always look over his shoulder before he goes backwards, or maybe the bus driver has lost that, you know, that art form of backing up, or the truck driver. So there are all these things that we used to do instinctively pre-COVID that now those muscles have to be exercised again and get back to this intuitive state. So the idea of, as the leader, making room for that on the show site, making room for compassion, making room for empathy, making room for the check-in, making room for the rustiness, that's the leaders we need coming out of COVID. And an immense tool for that is the mental health toolbox talk, or just the toolbox talk with a mental health component, where I say, I recognize we're all a little rusty. I recognize it's been a while since we've done this. I want you to know I don't care about every minute on the clock as much as I care about you going home tonight. We're here for you. Please be here for us. If you've got an issue, or if you're feeling like you're not up to it mentally, or if anything else is causing you to feel unsure, take a break, tap out, come see me, come see your boss, whatever that might be. But saying those words out loud to every human and valuing every human on the show site, whether that's the caterer, the runner, the forklift, the driver, the venue owner, whoever that is, that sets us up for the new world we all want to live in together, I think. That's going forward to work as opposed to going backward to work. I'm going to steal that from Riley. And I think that's who we want to be, or at least that's who I want to be when we come back out of it.
I love that so much. And I think with all of these conversations that we've been having over the past year that have, a lot of them have been very, very broad and very abstract, and people have been trying to kind of figure out a way to actually apply this. And I think that's an amazing place to start. And like I said, when I saw that, you know, behind the scenes actually gives you the pre-written scripts, and then they also can help you come up with your own. I feel like the tools are there, right? The help is there. And now I feel like we really are in a phase of, because people have been putting in the work, these organizations have been doing the work, and they've been putting together the resources, and they've been putting together the great minds to help figure these things out. Now it's really a time to talk about them and to put them out there and get them incorporated into our everydays. So amazing.
Yeah, I might even take that one step further and say, you know, now's the time for those who do the hiring to value those things as equal to the technical skills that you might come along with. Hey, you know, are you going to be additive to this team? Are you going to help us look out for each other to this team? You know, because these resources like mental health first aid training from Behind the Scenes Charity, because they're now easily accessible, like the ESAT training from the Event Safety Alliance, there's a new measure of reasonable, right? So your duty of care is measured that you're doing your job against someone else who does a similar job, and you know, their measure of reasonable. So I think the bar is a little bit higher now. I think the bar says, and this is aspirational, but I think that, and easy to achieve, but I think the new measure of leadership is, how much have you invested in yourself to be able to look after the humans that you're working around and working with and have the duty of care for? Because you can't say, oh, I can't find mental health first aid training anymore. Behind the Scenes Charity fixed that. Right? You can't say, I can't find safety training anymore. Event Safety Alliance, fix that. You know, there are any number of things that we can now do to professionally develop ourselves. And I think the leaders of tomorrow will value those things more than the things we used to value, be that, you know, heavy escape time and decompression time and all the things that were fun, but didn't add to our skills or add to a world where we took better care of the humans around us.
I love that. Well, Jim, we only have a few minutes left. So I wanted to ask you, because I'm curious, what is something that you are incorporating into your life and career moving forward so that you can continue to have a sustainable, balanced to, you know, whatever extent we can balance life?
So great question. I didn't understand work-life balance before COVID. I didn't understand that some of the things I was asking people around me to do and calling at 3 a.m. to say, hey, I got this great idea, was a violation of a boundary. You know, I felt that the passion that I was bringing to a particular thing was equaled by those around me that I had as part of the team, be they volunteer or not. So I now understand better what boundaries are, and I've committed to respecting those in others, but I'm also finding that, you know, I've never been home for more than 2 months until COVID. So it was quite the transition to get my wife to allow me to stay in the house for this long, to, you know, to be a participant father, and all these other things. And I also understand boundaries now for myself. So I think work-life balance has a greater value for me than it ever did, outwardly and inwardly. And I think I've come to really enjoy the idea of continuing to upskill and continuing to upskill, even at my age. You know, I am thirsty for anything new that appeals to me, that I want to learn, that I know that I can use to help those around me in either by leading because I've learned it or because I know how to look out for someone's health and welfare. So work-life balance is one of them. And I've also never been able to take care of myself physically. I've never been able to be a person at a gym that goes routinely and who runs routinely and who eats healthy. And all of that I do now. And I'm not sure how that's going to work when I go back out. And it's scary. And because I've had this chance to figure it out and to feel it and to test it and to taste it, now I'm like, I don't really want to separate from that.
Well, that's something we can work out, right? Because you're right. There's going to be a transition, and a lot of people have picked up some good habits. There have also been some bad ones that we may want to drop. But you know, how do we take those good habits that we've built up and transition them into our typical life on the road? So,
yeah,
I'm excited to see if we can come up with any ideas. But thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it. You are great, and I hope we talk soon.
Janine, thank you so much for the opportunity to talk with you. I'm grateful. Thank you.
Are some key takeaways from my conversation with Jim Digby. 1, doing something you're passionate about for a living doesn't always happen unintentionally. We don't always know where our passion will lead us, but it's important to surrender to your passion and to let it guide you toward a career doing something you truly enjoy. 2, we can't change where we come from, who we were, and what we've done, but we can learn from it, grow, and do better. 3, management and leadership are two different things. Great leaders ask what tools you need in order to get the job done and be your best self. 4, the new measure of leadership is how much have you invested in yourself in order to be equipped to take care of the humans you work with. And 5, in order to be a great leader and to take care of the humans on your team, it's important to invest in learning how to truly show up for them. So please go to btshelp.org/mentalhealth and register for mental health first aid training. And don't forget to check out showmakers.com for various other resources. Thank you so much for joining us on the Tour Life podcast. Be sure to give Jim a follow on Instagram @DigbyJim. And don't forget to like, subscribe, leave a review on iTunes, and to follow The Tour Life on Instagram @TheTourLifePodcast.